Hitchcock podcast with your hosts Brandon Shea Mutala, Chris Hay, and Tom Caldwell. I'm Tom. This is Brandon.
Hello.
And Chris will be joining us later. He is our foreign correspondent. He has very serious international spy things to do over in Britain that he's not allowed to tell us about. So we're only allowed to talk to him at limited times.
So is he a spy in Britain when he's from Britain?
And I don't think we're allowed to say spy.
What do we say?
Well, he's a professional businessman, or I'm not sure.
Well, Tony Soprano was a
waste management technician.
Waste management. So.
I believe he probably does something in dealing with champagne, or
as long as he's not going to blackmail me, I'm like
selling Mountain Eagles.
Mountain Eagles.
There is a bit of suspicion about. What he does, but without a shadow of a doubt, I'm confident he'll be with us later in the episode.
Wonderful.
There you go. So today we're doing biography. We're talking about Alfred Hitchcock, and we're going to take from birth until much later in his life, and we're going to talk about his background, where he came from, and it's going to be a good episode. Episode 3, thank you for following us, those who have already listened to episode 1 and 2. This is our third venture at our new project, and we're quite excited to be here. So without any further ado, which in itself is further ado, I'm going to get into the birth of Alfred Hitchcock. So this was actually at the end of one era, the Victorian era, and it was a birth of a new era in film when Alfred Hitchcock came along. His parents were William Hitchcock and Emma Whelan. They were married in 1887. Now, William was the son of a greengrocer, and Emma's dad was a policeman. And their oldest son, William Jr., was born in 1892. Their daughter, Ellen Kathleen, was born in 1896. So, second-generation family, they became greengrocers again. Alfred Joseph Hitchcock was born August 13th of 1899, on a Sunday in Leytonstone. Now, I imagine Alfred Hitchcock being born, hearing himself scream, looking at all the blood, thinking, well, then we may be onto something here. He was very influenced at an early age. He was definitely raised in a strict household. They lived above their green grocery store at 517 High Road in Leytonstone, which is a suburban area east of London. And Hitchcock's father did make a comfortable living as a greengrocer, but dealing in perishable goods gave the family a certain insecurity. They never went hungry, because there was always fruits and vegetables to eat. But Hitchcock himself considered himself a bit of a speculator in perishables.
Yeah, so that's interesting that they had this family grocery store. I've got this book, Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan, and there's a great photograph that maybe we can see if we can get up on the website when this episode drops. It's at the 517 High Road. It was taken about 1906, and it has William Hitchcock proudly displaying Alfred J. Hitchcock on a horse in front of the family store and home. So I'll hold the picture up for you to see here, Tom.
Yeah, no, that is. I've seen other versions of that photo. That is wonderful. And what a classic setup. You know, the store on the main floor, living upstairs. That, you know, that's a really old school way of living. But they were, I'm sure they got their share of vegetables. They never had to tell their kids to eat their vegetables, I'm sure.
Do you think Hitchcock was a chubby baby?
A little bit. From eating too many vegetables.
Too many vegetables.
And like I said, his mom was an excellent homemaker. She was always cooking. The big treat for him was to go to the bakeries. Now, we talked about his older brother and sister. They worked in the store a lot, and Alfred really didn't have much to do with them. there was a bit of time gap between their ages. So he considered himself a bit of an only child. Hitchcock claims as a baby, he never cried. He claims he didn't engage in that waste of energy. He thought of that behavior as a loss of control and a loss of dignity. He does credit his mother for introducing him to fear. The family were Catholic. This had them in the minority. They loved the theater. Both of these things made them eccentric, according to Alfred. He was placed in a Jesuit school and was taught to fear anything evil. The students were subject to physical punishment with a hard rubber cane. That explains a few things. And he does trace the roots of his fear of the police to an incident in his youth.
In this book that I have, this Paul Duncan wrote that although the young Alfred was quiet and well-behaved, there's an apocryphal story. Now, I'm not the biggest English major out there, but as far as I understand it, apocryphal is a story that is basically taken on a life of its own and has become truth because it's been told so many times, but it may not actually be true.
Right, and there's five books I have on my table here, and every one of them has a version of this story. And you're right, like, is it a true story? Is it a made-up story? Have we heard it so many times? I'm pretty confident that Hitchcock made this story up because, oh, what a great story about, you know, why I don't like police. You know what I mean? It's good PR. Yeah. It's good background. He tells it every time, anywhere he goes. So I'm quite confident that that story is a bit of hype, a bit of PR.
Yes.
And what father would send his son alone to the police station? You know, like, rather than, I'm going to drag you down there. I'm going to walk you down there. But according to this story, Hitchcock walked by himself to the police station.
That doesn't sound right.
And it's a cliche thing that people, young children, get locked up in jail for a couple minutes and, you know, supposed to teach them a lesson. But, yeah, whether or not it's true, that's to be debated, I'm sure.
If the original police officer that did lock up Hitchcock is listening to this podcast, if you could call us and let us know, our number is 1-800-555-HITCH.
That's one too many digits. I'm more than happy to get you locked up for 10 or 20 minutes just to make things go smoother. Maybe we should do an episode from a jail cell. Anyway, Hitchcock was a pudgy boy, and he became isolated from other children as he had very little athletic ability and even less interest in the games that children played. So he was a loner of a child, always looking at things, always observing. He tells Charlotte Shadler in the book, It's Only a Movie, I wasn't a popular type. I was forced to live in my imagination, and I believe that for me to develop my creative resources, I don't need much stimulation from the outside world. I was forced to develop my interior self, not to be dependent on others. Then my work brought me a kind of appreciation, a love that I never expected. So this is where he got his love from. His popularity was from his creative work, where other kids might have got it from, you know, playing soccer or what have you. That's where he found that appreciation. And definitely live theater inspired him. He loved the green-lit villains in the melodramas, the heroine in her rosy pink light that was used to make her look more beautiful and pure. He was frequenting movie houses by the age of 8. And he really did take great wonder in watching the simple short films, which were not much, but they could have audiences screaming and ducking under their seats in fear of a train hurtling at the screen. People would wet themselves in terror. So that's where he came from as a youth, watching people react to the simplest of films and having that physical reaction. And I think that's what inspired him to get into the industry in such a strong way, which he did later in life.
Those theaters would stink.
Well, chances are they would stink before you got there. Or, you know, other people got there.
Yeah, for the previous person that thought the train was coming out of the screen. I've heard that story. I've seen that video where, like, the camera's set up, like, right next. I don't know what movie it is, but we saw it in a film class. The camera's, like, right next to the train tracks. And the train is, like, coming coming. It goes right past. And they told us that story. They're like, people like screamed and jumped out of their chairs because they thought the train was coming at them. And I was like, is it black and white?
If these same people were watching like the helicopters off the cliff in IMAX, you know, where they're flying over the mountains and stuff, they would
freak out. Forget that, man. I'm going back in time. When I invent a time machine, I'm going back in time and I'm going to bring the Saw movies with me.
So that's a good example of the naive audience of the day. They hadn't seen that before. That wraps up my section about Hitchcock from Born to 1910. And now let's go talk to Chris Hay for the teenage years.
So kind of from 1910 onwards, it's really a period of kind of transition and growth for Hitchcock. As, you know, Brandon, Shane, and Tom have spoken about, I'll basically be taking him all the way up through the 1910s and that era. And kind of at the start of this period, he began studying at a college in London called St. Ignatius College, which isn't really a college, but it's like a Jesuit Catholic secondary school. And obviously he came from very, you know, very strict background, religious background, which was kind of informing a lot of what he would later kind of go on to do effectively. And then in the years, you know, previous to that, because he started aged 11 at the college in 1910. The year after that, he then continues his education and then receives a distinction in mathematics. I'm not really sure kind of if that has anything to do with kind of the bearing on his education or if his kind of future progression or everything, but, you know, we've already spoken about the fact that he wasn't a particularly popular boy. He wasn't very, you know, well liked and all that sort of thing, so it would have been interesting to really sort of see how he would have progressed at that time, kind of education-wise. Like I said, as he's getting older, so in 1913, so he's just completed his education then at St. Ignatius College, and he would be, I believe he would be then 1930, so he would be 14 years old at the time. A couple of months later, he then enrolls in the London County Council School of Marine Engineering and Navigation, which is, I don't think it's there anymore from when I had a look around the area, but it's located on the High Street, which is in Poplar, London, and he went there to study draftsmanship and advertising design. Now, the advertising business, I think, stuck with him pretty much the rest of his life. Not only did it affect his films and all that sort of thing, but there's little nods to it throughout his subsequent works. The one I think of, and it's literally just a tiny cameo, but I think it's brilliant, is where he appears in the newspaper ad, and it's like, I think he's like the before in
it's the weight loss ad.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I honestly, God, at this moment I can't remember what film it is, but I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty funny, all that sort of thing. And I personally like to think that the advertising design, it would go to then kind of influence how he advertised and sold a lot of his films. So with Rear Window, you've got the, you know, the trailer for it is effectively him saying, yes, no, this is, you know, the set of my new film and everything, and, you know, him being very candid and talking about it, and he says, oh, well, that's going to happen. And then my favourite is the Psycho trailer, which I think is brilliant, because it's basically him going saying, oh, that's where they found the body, just, oh, nasty business, all that sort of thing. And the idea that once Psycho had started, they wouldn't let anyone into the cinema, you had to watch it from the beginning, and so it kind of created this kind of furore and everything. And I personally like to think that he picked up some stuff from that there, and particularly at such a young age, so he would have been 14 when he started there, because back in the 1910s, education didn't mean, for example, in the UK, it's now you have to stay in school until 16. You are now guaranteed a place basically at any sixth form college until you're 18 now, but back then it was pretty much high school or secondary school was all the way up until 14, and then you either went off to like another prep college and then went to uni, I don't think he was personally in a position to actually go on and do anything in with regards to that, but it did give him kind of a jump into a career that he didn't stick with, but it did help influence a lot of his later kind of career decisions and career choices. The year after that, 1914, so then what then happens is that so following his studies at the London County I hate the name of this, it's so long, the London County Council School of Marine Engineering and Navigation, he then begins working for a company called W.T. Henley's Telegraph Works Company, where he's initially employed with the sales department, which I don't really know how I imagined that, like a tiny, like Alfred Hitchcock trying to sell stuff, because he, you know, lovely guy. I'm not really sure how great on the charisma he would have been in the sales department. He was very good at selling films, and he was very good at selling in that sort of way, but I just can't really see him, you know, succeeding in a kind of sales associate role. And then, unfortunately, the end of 1914 is marked very, very sadly, on the 12th of December, Sir Alfred Hitchcock's father, William, he dies then from chronic emphysema and kidney disease, which is a, it is a real shame. And in, I mean, I can't speak for any of his decisions, but a lot of his heroes, they're not exactly suffering from mother issues in the same way that a lot of, you know, like Cary Grant in North by Northwest and Psycho, Norman Bates, where they're suffering from like toxic kind of mother problems. But equally, there's an absence of real father figures in a lot of Hitchcock's films. A lot of the times the father is deceased, a lot of the time the father is kind of a non-entity. So I do wonder if this has kind of played an impact or not. The year following that, this isn't really Hitchcock, but it is, you know, the most important kind of person in his life. So a 16-year-old Alma Reville, who would then become his, you know, his right-hand woman, his partner, his wife, she then enters the film trade ahead of him, and secures a job as a film cutter at the London Film Company, which I think is fantastic, because she would go on to edit a lot of Hitchcock's kind of early work, and then she'd be, you know, a consultant on the vast majority of his films. So it's fantastic to see that she kind of started early, and she was given a job like that fairly early on. In that same year, so Hitchcock is like, he's gone through the training, he's gone through everything, and he decided he doesn't want to be an engineer, even though he's educated and he spent years training to be an engineer. He decides he doesn't want to. So then he decides to go on an evening course at Goldsmiths College to study art. And I think this is really where his kind of artistic sensibility started to come out. So the course leads to an appreciation of fine art, and this deeper interest in film and theatre. And during this period, then Hitchcock starts to go out and kind of voraciously see new plays and new films and all that sort of thing. So it does build on that kind of interest he has as a child, and now he just kind of starts to do it more and more. So then on the 5th of December, which is roughly, I think it's like a week or so, it's a week before the 1 year anniversary of her father's death, Hitchcock's sister Ellen Kathleen Hitchcock, she marries a licensed victualler, which I had to look up what that meant, and it turns out it's the individual at a pub or a drinking establishment or a bar who is actually licensed to sell alcohol on the premises. His name was Harry Lee. His family ran the Copenhagen Tavern on Salmon Lane. It was a Roman Catholic ceremony, which makes sense because they came from a fairly religious background, at the Church of St. Mary and St. Michael in East London. They were very fortunate enough to have three children before Harry dies, very sadly, in 1924, aged only 31, which is it's a real shame. It's really young. Okay, so the next year, 1916, so he then sees, and it's kind of an important play that he sees kind of in the chronology of Hitchcock. So he sees a stage play called Who Is He, which is based on the 1913 book The Lodger by Mary Bullock Lowndes. So it's important in case you're not aware. So basically, The Lodger was one of the first films that Hitchcock actually decided to, you know, adapt into a film, and then he adapted it into a radio play in the 40s. The Lodger is this fantastic, I think it's 1924 that came out. I might be completely wrong about that. But it is a fantastic silent film, and it's kind of one of his early great masterpieces. Okay, this is just a little sidebar. But on the 10th of May, this is the fictional setting for his film Secret Agent, which was in 1936. Apparently, it takes place on the 10th of May, 1916. So he does... He is deliberate sometimes in setting his films during particular time periods rather than, you know, just letting them be of the present day or just framed in a general time period. He was very specific about this one particular film. In 1917, so this is with the First World War, it's entering its third year, an 18-year-old Alfred Hitchcock is declared unfit for military service due to medical problems, and so he continues to work at Henley's Telegraphic Works. However, despite the fact that he wasn't able to actually join the army, he instead decided to kind of sign up for the Royal Engineers, and then he also took part in evening and weekend exercises, which include marches around Hyde Park, which is very nice. it's good. It was patriotic. It was, you know, I think it did affect his, you know, later life, in that he didn't actually see conflict like a lot of his contemporaries did.
The marching was not true military action, but it really would serve a purpose for those who got to see it and for the men who participated.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things where it's, I mean, you know, obviously I wasn't around them, but it's that kind of symbolism that still takes place, and it would have been, it definitely helped kind of keep the home fires burning and to make sure that people didn't really lose sight of what it was all about. So yeah, even if you were declared unfit for service, whatever reason, I think the fact he did join, and even if it was only like, you know, weekend exercises, you know, in World War II there was stuff like the Home Guard and all that, but no, it would have been important, and I like to think it gave him a bit of, I suppose, a feeling of belonging, of contributing to the war effort at that time. In that same year, on the 1st of March, Henry William Lee, which is Hitchcock's nephew, is born to Ellen and to Harry Lee in London, so he gets to be an uncle, which is, you know, very nice for him. And then in October of that year, and just talking about kind of patriotism and all, you know, the effect it had, on the 20th of October, Hitchcock's cousin, Charles James Hitchcock, he dies from injuries sustained while fighting in Egypt in World War One. He'd served as a private in the 3rd County of London Yeomanry, which is kind of not colloquially, but the nickname is basically the Sharpshooters. And he was also part of the Machine Gun Corps. Previously, he'd managed to, you know, fight in Gallipoli and in Palestine. Very sad event for the family, but unfortunately, it's not one that's wholly limited to Hitchcock's family. And then he was, Charles James Hitchcock was then buried at Beersheba War Cemetery. I'm not really sure quite where that is, but from what I was able to dig up around the subject, it's quite a prominent war cemetery close to the area. So in late 1917, Hitchcock requested to be transferred from the sales department at Henley's to the advertising department, which he'd had some prior experience of working at the college he previously went to. So then in early 1918, he did a news post where his responsibilities include helping to design the company's sales brochures and advertising materials, which, as we've chatted about previously, it could go on to then influence decisions. He gets to experience that kind of the control in creating a product. He's already shown kind of like an artistic design. If he's able to create like a product or something to his exact, maybe not his exact specifications, but to, you know, have creative control over a thing, I wouldn't be surprised if this was an influence, given that he was known to have very exacting standards on a film. I've heard stories where he was very particular about the wardrobe, very particular about, you know, each individual thing about a particular character. So I wouldn't be surprised if this was some kind of large influence on him. In the January of 1918, Hitchcock's brother-in-law, Harry Lee, he enlists and joins the Navy, and then he is sent over to Roehampton, where he works as part of the ground crew for the Royal Naval Air Service. So he could be part of the RAF, he could be a more specific section of it. I'm not really that great on the specifics of the RAF, but it is... you know, it's fantastic. If he was part of the ground crew, then he was definitely helping keep people safe and keeping the machines running as best as he could. In September of that year, then Harry and Ellen then welcome another child into the world, which is Ellen Marcella Lee, born in the same area on the 26th of September. And then finally, 1919... So basically, it's some of these are more kind of tangentially related to Hitchcock, but they are important. So in April 1919, there's a US film company called Famous Players. Famous Players Lasky. They announced that it plans to open studios in the UK, and development work begins in October 19 in Islington, which is an area in London, and those officially open in 1920. They become an important area, basically, for Hitchcock to examine and to, you know, actually take part in. And he kind of hones his film craft there. In June of that year, he's now settled into his new role in the advertising department. So Hitchcock becomes the editor of two of the kind of new in-house magazines for Henley's. The main one is the Henley Telegraph, and the initial issue, dated the 1st of June 1919, includes a contribution from Hitchcock, which is simply entitled Gas, which is nice and mysterious. And then finally, in September 1919, the Henley Telegraph then contains a contribution from Hitchcock, which is entitled The Woman's Part. And then that moves then on into the 1920s.
Hitchcock was an outsider. As a child, he wasn't popular with the other children.
Yeah.
He never participated in the sports and the games that the children played. In the war, he wasn't able to go into action. He was held back. He never got to fight. Even in the RAF, he was ground crew. He never even, you know, he never got to fly. He never got to be the pilot.
Mm.
He was always the outsider looking in.
Yeah, no, exactly. He is, you know, the complete outsider. He can't join the army for certain reasons, so he's denied that experience. He, you know, like you said, he was, you know, a bit unpopular and all that sort of thing. You know, he starts to seek kind of validation in different ways. So, it, you know, when he goes and sees new plays and new films, and it's to, you know, feel that artistic temperament, I wouldn't be surprised if it's also kind of the sense of belonging, I guess. He does strike as a kind of, not even odd in a way, but kind of someone who's kind of detached from, you know, who's kind of like from the outside looking in. And I think that does help him as a filmmaker in a sense, because he had to do stuff that was naturally different from the crowd, and so he had to take different perspectives from it. If he'd been so completely, yep, you're just one of the group, you're just one of that sort of thing, he might have been happier, I dare say, but he wouldn't have been able to create the films, in particular the films which focus so much on kind of the outsider perspective, you know, such as, well, the one that springs to mind for me personally is Frenzy, because you've got the outsider perspective not only of the kind of beleaguered protagonist, you also have it of the villain, who is the complete inverse. He is someone who is very much accepted by society, but who has this kind of inner darkness that he can't really express, whereas the guy on the other end is someone who society has kind of rejected, but is, you know, very normal and just wants acceptance and that sort of thing. So I won't be surprised if there's, you know, a little bit of Hitchcock in a lot of his, in a lot of his protagonists and a lot of his kind of surrogates, in a sense, in the film.
His math and science and engineering studies, they do pay off, and they do help him become the organized, careful, committed filmmaker which he becomes.
Well, yeah, no, I completely agree. So he basically, you know, like you said, because, you know, he does have like an art, you know, the artistic, and, you know, he really wants this and this, but because, like you said, he does have that mechanical background, he is able to say to camera, kind of, cruise and go, right, I want it to be exactly this, I want it exactly this kind of lighting, because I want this effect, I want, you know, and he's able to actually explain it to them in a way they understand. It's not someone who's, you know, who doesn't know how a camera works, but he's really good at, like, steering it around. He's got that kind of, oh yeah, no, it happens for this reason, and he's got that that kind of mechanical, scientific mind. Which I agree with you. I think it helps. It kind of marries the two perspectives.
And we are going to start talking now about Hitchcock from 1919 on, and really his early work in the film industry.
Yeah, you bet. So Hitchcock got his original foot in the door, let's just say, by working as a title designer on silent films. Now, for those who maybe don't know, I mean, like, this is a long time ago, films used to be silent. They didn't have audio to sync up with it. So how did they convey the story to the audience? Well, with lots of overacting and lots of wonderful visuals, but every once in a while popping up on screen would be a descriptive phrase of something that maybe a character was saying, or to explain a transition in scene or something like that. And so Hitchcock would design these titles that would pop up in between. So now there's not a lot that I was able to find about this. You know, there's a lot on the names of the movies that he worked on, and most of them are actually lost to time. Now, again, back 100 years ago when they started making films, nobody was preserving films. They'd make it, they'd release it, and like that was it, and they would be gone. So a lot of Hitchcock's early works that he worked on are not available anymore, and they're lost to time. I heard an interesting story about a silent film called, I think it's The Passion of Joan of Arc, which is a film by Carl Dreyer, and this movie was thought lost for an extremely long time, and somebody found a copy of this film in a closet in a mental asylum in, like, France somewhere, or something like this. Now, don't quote me on the country. I can't remember exactly. I'm just kind of winging off the top of my head, but they talk about it on the Criterion Edition release. So, you know, people just had these films and just tossed them wherever.
You talk about, like, that's the era, like you said, they wanted to distribute the film, show it in the theaters. Nobody was concerned about, did we keep a copy in the library? Mm. There was a story where North American syndicate, like the B-movie theaters, eventually the films would get shipped up to Alaska, and because that was the longest route, like after 2 years of being shipped town to town, and someone in Alaska had to tear out a swimming pool. So they filled the swimming pool with films. They used them as landfill and cemented over this pool, and eventually people realized what had happened, and they unearthed all these films, and they were finding dozens of copies, one-of-a-kind copies of old films. So it was never a science to keep the libraries intact.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating, you know. And some of the places where they found these lost films are just outrageous, you know. So in 1919, Hitch learned that there was a famous player's Lasky opening a studio in London, and that the first film was going to be called The Sorrows of Satan, which ended up not being released until 1926. But he went up there, he bought a novel, drew designs for title cards, and submitted them with a portfolio, and ended up getting a job working with them. Now, one of the interesting things about film at that time is that famous player's Lasky had some of their top American talent that was brought to them. Right, they had people like Eve Unsell, Margaret Turnbull, and let's see if I can say this right, Ouida Burguier in the editorial department. And it was customary for women to write and edit the movies. And those were the three women who knew everything about that kind of work on the films. Now, Hitchcock made himself completely indispensable to the film company by doing all these different things. He worked on short films with title design. He worked on feature-length films. He ended up moving up into the art direction and art directing department. And it's tough to know. Like, I can give you the names of the movies that he worked on, but even knowing when these movies came out has kind of been lost to time. I've not actually been able to find two websites that kind of corroborate for dates. Like, for example, The Great Day was the first short film that he worked on, and I have some websites saying that it was released in 1920, and some saying it's released in 1921. So even there, some of that information has been lost to time. But there was a few people that he did work with over and over. He worked with a director named Hugh Ford, who was an American film director and screenwriter. And Hugh Ford directed or co-directed 31 different films. And a lot of the same actors were in a lot of these movies. But yeah, he worked with Hugh Ford on quite a few things. Now, some of the early movies that he worked on. So there's The Call of Youth, The Great Day, Appearances, Dangerous Lies, The Mystery Road, The Princess of New York, and The Brawny Bierbrush. Now, those are listed as 1921 releases. And then in 1922, before he started directing his own stuff, we have The Three Live Ghosts, Perpetua, which is also known as Love's Boomerang, The Man from Home, and The Spanish Jade. And some of these films he's uncredited on. He just did some extra work for them. But I think it's really fascinating that he worked on so many of these films that are just lost to time. And, you know, one of the films, where was it here? I wrote it down, is actually still available. Apparently it's not lost. And I was trying to search to see if I could find it on YouTube or something. But if somebody knows where we might be able to find it, I think I might like to check it out. I didn't look too deep because, you know, it's just a film that he did art direction and title design on, right? So there's not much Hitch influence on it, but there's a film from 1922 called The Man from Home, which is apparently still available. And I Googled and I searched it and I found a website that was asking for my credit card information in order to watch it. And I didn't really want to do that.
A point of order here. If you ever misplace your credit card number, I use it all the time.
Oh, so good. Okay. Thanks, Tom.
I've got a backup copy.
Excellent. Oh, that's scary. So anywho, but yeah, so he worked with a lot of people frequently. You know, George Fitzmaurice was another director that he worked with a couple times. John Stewart Robertson. So yeah, he worked his way up the ladder before he got into his first film, which we'll be talking about in the next episode, number 17, which actually ended up being an uncompleted film. He never finished it, but he worked his way up the ladder in the film studio business.
Well, and that's technology. Like, you think about today, nobody would ever lose track of a film today because everyone has pirated copies. But even the Johnny Carson show back in the day, if Johnny himself hadn't put money into archiving the episodes, a lot of them would have been lost because they needed the tapes. They needed the videotape. Like, they didn't have the money to be putting videotape on a shelf and keeping it. So it's an issue of technology is what it is, that they didn't have the wherewithal to keep reliable copies of film back at that time, back in that era.
And I don't think people knew how big film would become and how important a place it would be in our culture. You know, like, film and movie stars is a huge chunk of our entertainment factor, television included, right?
Oh, for sure. And obviously nobody realized that, hey, Alfred Hitchcock is doing this film. You know, 100 years from now, they're still going to be teaching university classes and, you know, idolizing his work. This is important.
And a couple monkeys from Saskatchewan are going to be doing some podcast about him.
Yeah, and a British monkey. And
a British monkey.
Nobody realizes at that point, you know, how important his work is going to be. And more than likely, they're concentrating on, let's get the shows exhibited, let's get the theaters the copies they need, you know, let's sell the tickets.
Well, do you have any final thoughts on the early life of Alfred Hitchcock?
Well, it's very logical. It's very progressive, right? He comes in, he does the smaller pieces here and there, producing and writing, and then eventually grows to become what he was and takes over the entire productions and again, like Chris and I were talking about, with his background, he had this mathematical training, this engineering training in his school years, and he also had the arts and science background, like the appreciation of plays and drama. So he had a very good combination of skills that really served him well as a director on set.
I think I'm looking forward to this. This is going to be a lot of fun. This podcast is going to be a lot of fun in exploring what he could do and what his unique talents brought to the film screen.
Like you've said in previous episodes, we want to have feedback from the listeners, all 12 of them.
All 12
and of them. We want to hear what are your ideas. We want to hear what are your questions. What are your suggestions for an episode? What are your resources or what are your thoughts on interesting stories about Hitchcock that we could talk about? Brandon, give us some of your favorite ways for the viewer to contact us.
Well, aside from Soup Can and String, there's a couple of more modern ways you can get a hold of us. As far as the Alfred Hitchcock podcast itself, you can find us on Facebook. Simply look up Good Evening Podcast on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Good Evening Pod. You can email us, goodeveningpodcast@hotmail.com. As well as, don't forget that we're available on the Fandom Podcast Network, which is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook. You can email fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com, Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and Twitter, @FanPodNetwork. So those are all the ways you can find us and our distributors, the wonderful Fandom Podcast Group. So join us again next time as we discuss some of the early Hitchcock lost films. So have no fear, episode 5 is coming, and that's where we'll be covering our first actual film that you can watch along to, which is called The Lodger. But next episode, we'll be covering and talking a little bit about the lost films that he directed, which are The Pleasure Garden, The Prude's Fall, Number 13, Always Tell Your Wife, Woman to Woman, The White Shadow, The Passionate Adventure, and The Black Guard. So we'll just kind of have a general discussion, kind of like we had tonight, because all we have is a few stills. That's really all we have to go on.
We'll be talking about film regarding films that aren't films, basically. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. My name is Tom Caldwell, my Regina neighbor, Brandon Shea Mutala, and on behalf of Chris Hay, our foreign correspondent over in Britain, thank you all for joining us, and we hope to talk to you next time on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast.